Hello, everybody. This is Georgia Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we're very blessed to have with us David Seeloff. David is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. He does carry on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. And we've been working on a series, and I believe tonight is the last installment in that series, and it is we're going to be dealing with chapter 13 of The Star of Bethlehem, the star that astonished the world. And this has really been a series that's had some great history and gives us a look at how things were. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgia. And yeah, this has really caught the interest of a lot of people.
Great.
And had a lot of good response from this. And this is the last chapter, and there are four appendices in this book, only one of which we'll cover. The other three are very technical and can be viewed on the ASK website.
Yeah.
But the one appendix I want to go through deals with the sabbatical years. And it's reference to the birth of Christ and his ministry and his life.
Yes.
But this chapter that we're going to go through, the last chapter, is chapter 13. It's titled The Chronology of Josephus. And actually it deals with, puts everything together into the chronology of events regarding the birth of Christ. So let's get into the text of The Chronology of Josephus, chapter 13, of the star that astonished the world, reading Dr. Martin's words. The new historical information that has now come to light focuses on the fact that Herod's death in 1 BC and the birth of Jesus in 3 BC, but the main reason historians have accepted the March 13, 4 BC eclipse as the one associated with King Herod's death is because of two primary factors. The first is a chronological indication made by Josephus concerning Herod's length of reign, and the second involves the length of reign of the sons of Herod, who were his successors. Let us note that what Josephus said about the year's lengths, the year lengths of King Herod's reign. We have to say lengths in the plural because Josephus actually gave us two such indications. He said that Herod had a reign of 37 years from the time he was proclaimed king by the Romans, and 34 years from the death of Antigonus, which occurred after Herod captured Jerusalem. Now, and this is in Josephus, Antiquities, Book 17, Number 190. Scholars have been prone to say that these indications would date the death of King Herod to the year 3 BC. But unfortunately, or in reality, there was no eclipse of the moon in that year. The nearest eclipse was that of March 13, 4 BC, and since astronomical data are such powerful evidences, many scholars within the last 100 years have felt it necessary to stretch the chronological statements of Josephus to make them fit the time of this eclipse. They do not mind stretching the facts in this regard because they have to in order to rescue the March 13th eclipse as the one associated with Herod's death. This is why Professors Vermesh and Millar acknowledge that Josephus reckoned 1 year too many. This is in their book, The New Surer, page 326. All scholars recognize this discrepancy in trying to resolve Josephus' chronological statements. To mend this disparity, it is assumed that Josephus has adopted a scheme of reckoning parts of 1 year, only the first few days of a year, as answering in a legal sense to an entire year. If 2 or 3 days can be accepted as representing a whole year in Josephus' account of the number of years of Herod's reign, then these few days would allow Herod's last year to be extended back to the 1st of Nisan on the Jewish calendar, March 29 in 4 BC. And then a whole year can be awarded him in a de jure sense. With this type of reasoning, modern scholars suggest that Herod would have died 2 or 3 days after the 1st of Nisan, the start of the Jewish ecclesiastical year. But for legal reasons, in reckoning King Herod's reign, the whole year from 1 Nisan 4 BC to 1 Nisan 3 BC is considered by them as the last regnal year, the last year of reign of King Herod. Not everyone, however, buys this explanation. Professor Barnes will not accept the eclipse of March 13, 3 BC as proper. Barnes makes it clear that the time between King Herod's death and the next Passover, which Josephus said occurred after King Herod's death, is too short an interval to witness all the recorded events associated with King Herod's funeral procession, the period of his mourning, and the other events that occurred before that Passover. And this is in Barnes, in the Journal of Theological Studies, Volume 19, 1968, page 209. But this does not end the matter, however. The second reason many scholars have placed King Herod's death in 4 BC is because it has been supposed that Herod's three successors seem to have their reigns commencing in that year. But this is not so. As I have shown previously in this book, Dr. Martin writes, that David W. Beyer, in his work titled Josephus Reexamined, Unraveling the 22nd Year of Tiberius, he demonstrated that a great deal of competent research into the manuscripts of Josephus that shows King Herod's son, Philip, began his reign in 1 BC and had a 37-year reign, dying in the 22nd year of Tiberius, as the older manuscripts of Josephus show, and not in the 20th year of Tiberius that scholars have accepted today. And Dr. Martin says he will discuss the seeming chronological disparities regarding Herod's other two sons in a little while. These disparities have allowed scholars in the past to accept the eclipse of March 13, 4 BC, as untenable as it is. They felt justified in stretching the historical records almost beyond recognition to make them fit in their chronological interpretations. While they were well aware that their assumptions had considerable difficulties associated with them, they did not think it necessary to tell the public in most of their general works or encyclopedias that there were major problems in accepting these appraisals. But the public has a right to know the facts involving the historical circumstances concerning this very important period of time. If scholars would simply state that their appraisals are mere possibilities among other explanations, then their guessing might be acceptable as conjectures to explain the difficulties. But more often than not, this is the time when scholars express their blatant dogmatism. They do this in spite of the fact that classical historians state that the period from 6 BC to 4 AD is one of the most obscure decades in the history of the Roman Empire, as far as reliable records are concerned. This is where the difficulty arises in evaluating historical events of this obscure period. Still, utter dogmatism prevails. The theologians who make their dogmatic assumptions that they expect the general public to accept have thrown caution to the wind. It is now time to bring these problems out into the open for everyone to evaluate. Thankfully, it is gratifying to see that some scholars are now, when Dr. Martin wrote this in 1996, are now beginning to recognize that their past assumptions are not compatible with the facts of history, and this is a welcome trend. When finally all professionals seriously join the quest to attempt to sort out the truth, I have not the slightest doubt, Dr. Martin writes, that it will be seen that Herod died not long after an eclipse of the moon on January 10th, 1 BC, not a few days after the eclipse of March 13, 4 BC. Now we're going to look at the anomalies of Josephus. Now Josephus is not an easy author to understand relative to his chronological statements regarding earlier historical events of which he was not an eyewitness. As mentioned in an earlier chapter, besides the clear editing that has occurred in the manuscripts that make many of his chronological indications suspect, even the text of Josephus that can be reasonably trusted as being unedited is at times inconsistent with his chronological information. For certain periods, he avoids giving any chronological details at all, often at the very times when the modern historian needs them the most. For example, the main years of Archelaus, King Herod's successor, are glossed over with one or two general statements, and the period from 6 AD to the time of Pilate, the governor of Judea, in 26 AD is practically blank. No one knows why these discrepancies exist in Josephus, but they are there. There are, without doubt, several anomalies in Josephus' treatment of King Herod's reign. During the first years of King Herod, he buttressed his history with known and reliable chronological eras of time. For example, he equated King Herod's seventh year with the year following the Battle of Actium. And this was the battle in which Octavian defeated Antony and Cleopatra in the naval battle at Actium. And further, Josephus also gave a reference to the Olympiads. Josephus continued giving exact dates, supported by internationally known benchmarks of time, until King Herod's 28th year, which was a few years before the birth of Jesus. From then on, for some strange unknown reason, Josephus stopped giving chronological indications which would link the latter years of Herod's reign with known historical events. He did not resume his normal international time cross-references until the 10th year of Archelaus, the son of Herod, in 6 AD, and from then until the Jewish War of 66 AD to 73 AD, when Josephus gives chronological references again, and they are sensible. And at that time, of course, during the Jewish War, Josephus was an eyewitness. Why did Josephus abandon prime chronological indications in the latter years of King Herod and the beginning of Archelaus' reign? Well, this is a mystery. The fact is, some of the most important events in Palestinian history were occurring during that period, when the sons of Mariamne, one of King Herod's wives, were slain when the oath of loyalty took place, and over 6,000 Pharisees refused to sign the oath when Antipater, Herod's rebellious son, went to Rome, when Herod's brother Pheroras died, when the trial of Antipater happened, and when the golden eagle was destroyed, when the two rabbis were executed, the two famous honored rabbis were executed, and when Antipater was slain. For these events, there is not one cross-reference to the Olympiads, the Battle of Actium, any reference to events in the time of Augustus, or any other international benchmarks. This lack gives the historian a great deal of difficulty in precisely dating these events. Now, it's time now to perhaps harmonize the chronological difficulties. Let's now look at some possible reasons why Josephus, in the period of Herod, treated chronological matters in the way that he did. Josephus tells us that Herod died after a reign of 37 years, from the time he was made king by the Romans, and 34 years from the death of Antigonus. On the surface, scholars think this leads us to the year 3 BC for Herod's death. Or by reckoning 2 or 3 days of the year as an entire year, this could be stretched earlier back to 4 BC. But other historical data I will show in this book will not allow either 4 or 3 BC for King Herod's death. And Dr. Martin gives historical information in Appendix 4 that shows the sequence of sabbatical years for our period under discussion. Without doubt, the evidence indicates that Herod captured Jerusalem in the sabbatical year ending in late summer of 36 BC. And indeed, it was on the Day of Atonement at the conclusion of that sabbatical year. Since Antigonus was killed at a later period, Herod's rule of 34 years from the death of Antigonus works out nicely with what I am showing in this book. His year 34 would be from 2 to 1 BC. Now, Professor Galloway, in his book The Chain of Ages, written around 1860, in pages 460 to 465, in the last century, well, two centuries now, in the 1860s, saw the problem and suggested that King Herod's 34 years mentioned by Josephus were to be counted from the death of Antigonus some 3 years later. He did not believe Antony killed Antigonus immediately after Herod's conquest of Jerusalem, but had him executed 3 years later when Antony went to war against the Armenians. This explanation is also maintained by Cunningham in his book, The Fullness of Times, written in 1836, pages 94 to 97. The fact is, however, the interval of 3 years for Antigonus' death that these historians have suggested is not required, and there is no substantiation of it in the records. As a matter of fact, Antigonus could have been killed a few months after King Herod captured Jerusalem in 36 BC, and still Herod's death would work out to 1 BC. There are problems with these appraisals. Josephus calls Herod a king at least a dozen times between the day he was proclaimed king by the Romans and when he actually began to rule after capturing Jerusalem. His 37 years must be reckoned from the proclamation of his kingship by the Romans. And this makes a lot of sense. And this would seemingly bring Herod's last regnal year to be 3 BC. And there are the indications that two of Herod's sons who succeeded him in his government seemingly to have reigns dated from 4 BC. Now, there's a suggestion we have by historian W.E. Filmer. An ingenious solution has been offered. In October 1966, the Journal of Theological Studies carried an article by W.E. Filmer, which suggested a solution to the problem concerning the years of King Herod's reign, especially the year of his death. His suggestions can be summarized as follows. Most scholars feel that Herod's 37 years reign began in 40 BC and is 34 years from the capture of Jerusalem, which they think was in 37 BC. This brings us to 3 BC for King Herod's death. But this is 1 year beyond the March 13, 4 BC eclipse. And most scholars have failed to take this disparity into account. This is not the case with Professors Vermesh and Millar. They noticed that this major fault, and it prompted them to write, quote, "We know that Josephus reckons 1 year too many," end quote. The reason they are willing to admit that Josephus is off 1 year is in order, one would surmise, to protect the eclipse of March 13, 4 BC, as being the one referred to by Josephus. The acceptance of that eclipse as the proper one has forced astronomers to bend the rules in several ways. In other words, to bend the chronology. And this is why that early eclipse deserves no protection. Look at what the retention of this wrong eclipse has done. To accommodate the eclipse of 4 BC, scholars have been forced to count Josephus' years inclusively. This means they are willing to allow a mere 2 or 3 days of Nisan in 4 BC, when the Jewish ecclesiastical year began, to be counted as a whole year in the reckoning of Josephus. Professor Filmer, however, has given good evidence to show that Josephus did not count his years in this inclusive manner. This is also shown by Ormond Edwards in his book, quote, The New Chronology of the Gospels. And this is pages 27 to 33. Furthermore, Filmer also showed reasons that the capture of Jerusalem by Herod was not in 37 BC, but in 36 BC. And as we'll cover in Appendix 4 of this book, the sabbatical year at that time in which Jerusalem was captured was truly in 36 BC. Filmer's suggestion is absolutely correct. King Herod's 34 years of reign from the time of Antigonus' death after he captured Jerusalem must be reckoned from 36 BC, not from 37 BC. Filmer showed several reasons for this. Two of them involved sacred seasons of the Jews. When such seasons are mentioned in the historical sources, a greater amount of credibility can be given to the chronological statements in the records because the Jewish authorities would have long remembered important events that occurred on their holy days or sacred seasons. It was not uncommon for the general populace to place theological or prophetic significance to such occasions. So, what were the two sacred seasons that happened when King Herod finally captured Jerusalem? Josephus said that Herod's siege of Jerusalem was during a sabbatical year, and that a great scarcity of food was evident because of it. Sabbatical years occur, of course, every seventh year on the Jewish calendar. Modern studies of Watchholder, Professor Watchholder, and others demonstrate that 36 BC was indeed the end of a sabbatical year, as we'll cover in Appendix 4. And I show the result, Dr. Martin says, I show the results of that new research in Appendix 4. And Professor Marcus, in his notes to the Loeb edition of Josephus, shows that there are very good reasons for believing that the sabbatical year under discussion was to be reckoned from October 37 BC to October 36 BC. King Herod would have captured Jerusalem at the end of that sacred period. And there is one other historical reference involving a sacred Jewish day that substantiates this conclusion even more. All sabbatical years, according to the law of Moses, ended on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. And Josephus said that Herod's capture of Jerusalem coincided exactly with the Day of Atonement. He further stated that it was precisely to the very day, 27 years after the Roman general Pompey conquered Jerusalem in 63 BC. Clearly, this chronological fact leads one to the 25th of October, 36 BC, for King Herod's capture of Jerusalem. This indication is powerful evidence in which any scholar can place very high confidence that King Herod's 34 years of reign after Antigonus' death has to have 36 BC as a beginning benchmark. This is because sabbatical years stood out very remarkably to Jews who lived in Palestine at the time. This was a time when food was in short supply and when the whole of agricultural activity ceased. When a major event like King Herod capturing Jerusalem took place in a sabbatical year, that would have been long remembered. This was especially so because his capture was also on the Day of Atonement. Actually, though, Josephus got even more precise than simply the time that King Herod captured Jerusalem. He said that Herod's 34 years are to be reckoned from the death of Antigonus, which happened at a later period, and not simply from the day of Herod's conquest of Jerusalem. There were at least a few months after Jerusalem's fall before Antigonus was executed. By using the ordinary accession method of counting regnal years of Judean rulers, the actual date for the commencing of King Herod's 34 years was with the first of Nisan in 35 BC. This makes Herod's 34th year to start with Nisan in 2 BC, and it ends with Nisan in 1 BC. It must be remembered that all priestly years are reckoned from Nisan and not from the autumn month of Tishri. That's the civil calendar year. That's when that begins. The Hasmoneans, who ruled Judea before King Herod and whom Herod succeeded, were of priestly origin. It became common under their priestly rule for the kings in Jerusalem to reckon their years from Nisan and not from Tishri. In the Talmud, the later Jews understood this fact and stated that the later kings of Judah were accustomed to the Nisan to Nisan reckoning. And this is in the Talmud Avoda Zara 10a. In the earlier period, the custom of Judah was a Tishri to Tishri reckoning, as we mentioned in as Dr. Martin covered in chapter 6 of this book. So these historical references are quite reasonable. They're powerful witnesses that King Herod's conquest of Jerusalem was in late 36 BC, and Antigonus' death came sometime later. And remember, Josephus said Herod's 34 years commenced with the death of Antigonus and not at the capture of Jerusalem by King Herod. Professors Vermesh and Millar state that these historical indications represent, quote, a considerable difficulty to those scholars who wish to maintain either the year 38 BC or 37 BC as the year that Herod took Jerusalem. In truth, these factors make it impossible to consider the earlier years of 38 and 37 BC that have been guessed at by some theologians. The Jewish people have long remembered that particular sabbatical year and the holy day season regarding the taking of Jerusalem by King Herod. Pressing the siege, especially at the very end of a sabbatical year and on the Day of Atonement, would have made Herod an abominable character as far as the Jews were concerned. They would never have forgotten the outrage. Even Josephus remembered it well, and he stated that it was precisely 27 years to the day that Pompey previously committed his abominations in the temple. Now, there's a major problem with Filmer's suggestions. While Filmer's treatment of Josephus' reckoning for Herod's years of reign appears reasonable, there is one major stumbling block to it. Barnes, in his review of Filmer's position, which is in the Journal of Theological Studies, in Barnes' work, made it pretty clear that the historical records show that some of Herod's successors began their reigns in 4 BC, and not, as one might expect, in 1 BC. The Roman historian Dio said that King Herod's son Archelaus was deposed in his 10th year of reign in the consulship of Aemilius Lepidus and L. Aruntius. This answer to this answers to 6 A.D., and it means that Archelaus took over from King Herod sometime in 4 B.C., or at least it looks that way. There is even more evidence of this. Antipas was deposed by Emperor Caligula of Rome in 39 A.D., and there are coins which record his 43rd year. This evidence also leads one back to 4 B.C. for the beginning of Antipas' reign. The fact that these two sons of Herod, Archelaus and Antipas, seem to be reigning in 4 B.C. is the main problem to the thesis of Filmer. If King Herod died in 1 B.C., as Filmer and the evidence of this book suggests, why were two of Herod's successors reckoned as reigning as early as 4 B.C.? This, on the other hand, is not the case with Herod's son, Philip. And Dr. Martin says he has shown how David W. Beyer made it clear that the early manuscripts of Josephus show Philip to have started his 37 years of rule in 1 B.C. But why do the other two sons of Herod seemingly show a rule beginning in 4 B.C.? Well, there are historical reasons why this happened, and once they're understood, it shows that Filmer is right after all in his solution to the problem. Josephus said that in the summer before King Herod's death, Verus became governor of Syria. He took over that position from Saturninus. We have shown that this tenure could have been Verus' second governorship, extending from 2 B.C. to 1 A.D. Saturninus was governor the previous 2 years, from early 4 B.C. to the summer of 2 B.C. Verus had also been governor the first time before the rule of Saturninus, from 7 or 6 B.C. to 4 B.C. Josephus said that the governor before Verus' first governorship was a man named Titus. Now notice what Josephus said happened just before Saturninus assumed the governorship of Syria, which would have been in early 4 B.C., according to my dating of this in this book. King Herod sent his army to Arabia to end the activities of robbers who were hiding in the area and to collect a major debt that was owed to him by the Arabian ruler. And though the governors of Syria had given permission to King Herod for this action, Augustus was misinformed by Silelius, the Arabian, about the entire affair. Augustus responded by sending a stinging rebuke to King Herod. The message from Caesar, Augustus Caesar, was devastating. Quote, "Whereas of old he," meaning Augustus, "had used him as his friend, he should now use him as his subject." And this is in Josephus. Josephus mentions this. This declaration by Augustus was not a simple message of displeasure at Herod's actions. It had very serious political implications attached to it. To be a friend of Caesar was a title, Amici Caesararis, which was awarded to special individuals by the Roman government to show a close political relationship to the emperor. So pleased was Herod of Chalcis to have the designation that he had the title stamped on the coins of his realm. And at the time of Jesus' crucifixion, Pilate must have had the same honor from the then current emperor, because, quote, "The Jews cry out, saying, if you let this man go, you are not a friend, you are not Caesar's friend." And this is in John 19, verse 12. In regard to Pilate, this was tantamount to saying that he did not respect his title as Caesar's friend. Pilate took the charge very seriously. and decided to go along with the crowd and have Jesus crucified. But King Herod took it even more hard. Herod had now not only been stripped of his honorary title by the emperor himself, but he was further relegated to an even lower position by being reckoned as a subject. True enough, Herod was later reconciled to Augustus, but not before some tactical and strategic damage had been done to Herod's governmental standing with Emperor Augustus. This official reduction of King Herod's authority may well have prompted some major revisions in the way Rome looked at his government. Remarkably, a short time after King Herod's power was diminished, we find that Antipater, King Herod's eldest son, was now being acknowledged as reigning jointly with his father. And this was in Josephus also. Antipater was allowed to wear the purple robes, the symbol of kingship and rulership. Even Herod later admitted that his son had been given one half of the kingdom. It could well be that Roman authorities began from the summer of 4 BC to acknowledge a permanent joint rulership over the region of Judea. Obviously, Antipater could not have assumed such authority by himself, and Herod was also unable to bestow these honors on any of his sons unless Augustus gave permission. Josephus could well have figured this event into his reckoning of the reigns of Herod's successors. If Antipater could have a joint rule with his father, why not his other two sons? But Josephus' assessments may have been swayed by another important occasion that occurred about 2 years in 4 BC, 2 years before King Herod's death. This was an event that angered Josephus so much, and most of the Jewish nation, that he never forgave Herod for it. And this was King Herod's murder of his sons. From the time of Judas Maccabeus to that of Herod, the priestly family of the Hasmoneans had governed the Jewish nation. When King Herod came to power, he wished to solidify his political position in the nation by marrying Miriam, one of the surviving descendants of this dynasty. She was considered a queen. Herod had two sons by her, by the name of Alexander and Aristobulus. As these two sons grew up, they became very popular with the people, and many in the nation were hoping that they would gain the crown upon the death of King Herod. This would have meant a legitimate continuation of the Hasmonean dynasty. The designated heir of King Herod, however, was Antipater. This older son saw the two sons of Miriam as a danger to his own aspirations to rule. According to Josephus, Antipater concocted many false accusations against them and finally got the Hasmoneans alienated from the affection of King Herod. In his reflections about Antipater's schemes, Josephus waxed hot in anger, and he also castigated Herod for going along with the false invectives of Antipater and for having the monstrous gall of finally having the two royal sons killed about 2 years before King Herod died. Josephus spent considerable space in his histories utterly abhorring the entire affair. Indeed, it could well be said that he went overboard in his condemnation of King Herod and Antipater. Why he did so is not difficult to understand. Josephus had a double reason to be indignant with both King Herod and Antipater. First, he felt that the mistreatment of the Hasmonean sons and their subsequent executions were completely unjust. Secondly, Josephus was himself a descendant on his mother's side from this same Hasmonean family. So, when Herod came under subjection to Caesar, and with the legitimate heirs of Herod's kingdom now dead, Josephus, as well as the Jewish people, could have considered legal government at an end in Jerusalem. Even Augustus may have been deeply concerned over King Herod's execution of the royal sons, although Augustus gave permission for King Herod to do it. Professor Honer has shown that Augustus must have had a personal acquaintance with the Hasmonean sons that had been held in high esteem at Rome. And this was in Honer's book, Herod Antipas, page 271. So Augustus could well have decided that some governmental change was now necessary for the Judean area of the empire. After all, Herod was now quite old, and with his affairs and his own family in chaos, Augustus felt it was time to take more direct control in Judea. He revoked Herod's award as being Caesar's friend and demoted him further to being one of the subject class, a client, not even a client king, but a subject king. And recall, this was just after the time that Augustus also decreed that a registration of the empire should take place. Such a registration was a direct interference by Augustus in the governmental affairs of Judea. That oath that accompanied it, as I have said before, was no doubt a part of the registration mentioned by Luke. That would be in Luke chapter 2, verses 1 to 5. Such an oath was also administered to the people of the people of Judea at the accession of Caligula to the emperorship. And it too was prompted by a change of government. Professor Verkill, writing in the Revised Schurer, page 376, states that, quote, the oath of allegiance to the emperor, which the people were obliged to take, presumably at every change of government, and was mandatory already in the days of Herod, end quote. And this is in, Professor Burkhill's work. The fact that Josephus demanded the direct registration and oath for the people of Judea is a clear sign that he was becoming concerned over the political state of the area. It was a personal intrusion of the Roman emperor into the government of King Herod. The insistence upon the oath was also an indication to the people of Judea that they now owed their allegiance directly to the emperor and not to King Herod alone. By signing the oath, the Judeans were showing acceptance to the new political status of Rome in their affairs. The, quote, the oath was used as the conclusion of all kinds of legal dealings, particularly in political administration, taxation, and political and public documents. This is in Kittel's Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, volume 5, page 459. So what we have here is that Rome took direct control of the government of Judea. This change in the governmental status of Judea is reflected in another way, a way that which is very evident to anyone who studies the judicial powers of Herod during his time of reign. When Herod was first coming to power in Judea, he was to be tried by the Sanhedrin at Jerusalem for high crimes. And this is mentioned in Josephus, book 16, Antiquities of the Jews, book 16. But notice this important point. This trial was convened without any appeal to Rome for permission to execute King Herod if the sentence went in that direction. Later, when King Herod himself came to power in Judea, he and the Sanhedrin executed Hyrcanus without getting authority from Rome to do it. Herod put to death the royal queen Miriam and Aristobulus and the royal sons of Bappa, without consulting Caesar. And even later, Herod's son Alexander, who was one well-liked by Augustus, admitted that Herod still had power to execute him and his brother if he so desired. But, and this is an important point to note, once King Herod was demoted from being Caesar's friend, then Herod's power for executive action in regard to capital crimes was invalidated for persons of high rank. When Herod finally decided that Alexander and Aristobulus should be executed for their supposed crimes against him, he had to have Caesar's representatives in the province of Syria hear the case. In fact, Augustus even ordered that the trial be held in Beirut, a major province within the province of Syria, now in what we call Lebanon, rather than Jerusalem, as one might expect in deference to King Herod. But at Beirut, Augustus ordered a whole battery of important people to judge the case. Saturninus, the governor of Syria, with his sons, Volumnius, the Syrian military administrator, a special envoy named Pedanius, with his own adjudicators. It was these Roman officials who made the final decision in the case, and not King Herod himself. And even later, when Herod's son Antipater was tried for high crimes, Verus, the governor of Syria, was in Jerusalem to hear the case. Even then, Herod had no power to execute Antipater unless Augustus himself gave the permission. All this shows a profound reduction of governmental authority for Herod, especially in the judicial sense. His decline in power began with his demotion from being Caesar's friend, and we have shown this to have happened about 2 or 3 years before King Herod's death. This demotion would have occurred in 4 BC. Even the later demand of Augustus for an oath of allegiance from the people of Judea with a registration of their names is also a clear sign that a governmental change had happened in Herod's realm. These things show that King Herod lost much personal power in 4 BC. There's another way of demonstrating governmental changes in his administration at this time. Recall that during the rule of Saturninus, for between 4 to 2 BC in Syria, Josephus spoke about, quote, governors, plural, in Syria. This is why the change to governors, plural. Even Quirinius had been sent to the region as a special procurator of the emperor to oversee its political affairs in Syria. Technically, King Herod's kingdom was under King Herod's kingdom was under the influence of the Syrian governors. If governmental changes were then taking place in Syria, such adjustments could well be reflected in King Herod's domains. This is especially true when one realizes that Herod was near the end of his life and Augustus knew that an unstable political situation was already developing in Judea. This could well have been a factor why Quirinius was sent to conduct the census and the registration of loyalty to Augustus among King Herod's subjects. Recall that Justin Martyr said that Quirinius was in actual fact a procurator when he was in Syria and Palestine. This meant that he was a special envoy of Augustus to conduct important governmental duties in these eastern areas. This also shows the concern that Augustus had about this important region of the empire. There is another important reason why the time of 4 to 2 BC could have been a period of governmental reorganization in Judea. From 4 BC onward, there was the joint reign of Antipater with King Herod. This joint rule is clearly stated by Josephus. From what Josephus records about the evil actions of Antipater, the designated heir of Herod, he must be acknowledged as one of the most iniquitous sons of any father that any father ever had. And though Josephus said that Antipater was, quote, co-ruler with his father and in no way different from a king, end quote, for the two-year period after the deaths of Alexander and Aristobulus, it was Antipater's constant activity to think up ways to kill his father. It was his constant activity. He involved many people in his plots and even prompted Herod's brother, Phinehas, into a plan to poison King Herod.
Oh, my gosh.
What a lovely family.
Yeah, really.
While Antipater was on a trip to Rome, Herod found out about his schemes. Notice he was out of Dodge City at the time.
Yes.
So that things could play out like the Godfather. Godfather 1 and Godfather 2. But, you know, most governments, even today, are just mafia organizations.
You're not kidding. No.
But anyway, King Herod found out about Antipater's schemes while Antipater was in Rome. Indeed, as time went on, the magnitude of the whole affair and the great number of people involved caused Herod to recall Antipater from Rome. He did not tell him the reason for his return. It sounds like the Russians, the way the Russians would do it. He did not tell him the reason for his return, but Herod's object was to judge Antipater before a court of law and to have him executed for his crimes. When Antipater got back to Jerusalem, he was brought to trial at once, and in one day was convicted of high treason, murder, and attempted parricide. He's a busy guy.
Yeah.
Busy, busy family. Family that slays together stays together.
You know. What's changed? Once again.
Herod immediately sent messages to Caesar asking permission to execute Antipater. Herod had to ask the governor at this time, and this shows his decline in authority. Herod then altered his will by excluding Antipater from any inheritance. The message finally came back from Caesar that Herod could either banish him to a remote part of the empire or kill him. You know, it's your choice.
Yeah.
The banishment for severe offenses meant a complete loss of all rights, including citizenship, Roman citizenship, in fact, family privileges, and even sonship. When Augustus' daughter Julia was banished about the same time, he considered her no longer to be his daughter. When Julia's name would come up in chance conversation, Augustus would sometimes quote a line from the Greek poet Homer, quote, "Better to have never married and childless to have died," end quote. Was there an expunging of such a person's name from official or family documents? This certainly was allowed in a Jewish environment. In the Bible, it is mentioned that if a person, family, or tribe left the true religion, he was to be excommunicated from the nation and his name blotted out from under heaven. And this is stated in Deuteronomy chapter 29, verses 17 to 21. Because of the idolatry of the tribe of Dan, it was little heard of in the latter part of the Old Testament. And in the New Testament, the tribe is not even reckoned among the 12 tribes of Israel in Revelation chapter 7, verses 4 to 8. You asked me about that previously, and I had forgotten about this.
Why do they call Dan the serpent by the wayside?
Well, it may have something to do with the idolatry, actually. Maybe that was a prediction.
Oh, my goodness.
They went over to the serpent.
Yeah.
You know, erasing names in genealogical lists was actually common. Remember, this all took place, much of this, during the dark period of the Roman Empire that we discussed in previous chapter.
Okay.
King Herod would have found enough biblical precedents for expunging Antipater's name from the public records, including his 2 years of joint rule with King Herod when he was also, when Antipater was also reckoned as a king. There are historical examples of such things. For example, chiseling away the names from the monuments of Egypt, even attempting to destroy the written records of Pharaoh Akhenaten, and Nabonassar's obliterating the accounts of previous Babylonian kings. And now, King Herod received permission to either banish his son, which would have meant the loss of sonship for Antipater, or to kill him. Herod decided to execute him, but he no doubt stripped him of all his family associations in an effort to degrade him completely before he executed him. And now that Herod again changed his will immediately after killing Antipater, directions for such a blotting out could well have been in his final testament. It could have been that Antipater's joint rule with Herod was now awarded retroactively to Herod's true successors to secure the blotting out of Antipater's memory. This is even suggested by what Josephus said about Archelaus, the chief successor of King Herod. There is the obscure reference that Archelaus was recognized as one that, quote, had long exercised royal authority, end quote. This was not actually true to fact. The mind of Herod had been poisoned against Archelaus. Only at the last moment of his life, when in desperation, did King Herod appoint Archelaus to be the heir to the kingdom. Why then was Archelaus reckoned as having authority with Herod in the latter years of Herod's reign, when everyone knows he was not in such power? He was no doubt awarded the years of Antipater's joint rule in a de jure sense, replacing Antipater's joint rule associated with his father in the Judean kingdom when the two royal Hasmonean sons were killed in 4 BC. We also have the evidence of coins to this effect. The immediate successors of Herod were reckoned in some ways as reigning in 4 BC, but this was the year when Herod was demoted in Augustus' eyes, and when Alexander and Aristobulus were slain. This year was not when King Herod died. It appears that Herod's successors were awarded regnal years in which they did not rule alone over their lands. When we analyze the historical data after the death of Herod, we find interesting evidence which justifies this appraisal. The first information comes from coins that were minted by King Herod's later successors. The grandson of Herod the Great, through his Hasmonean wife, Miriam, was Herod Agrippa I. He reigned over Judea from 38 AD to 44 AD, which was a 7-year period. But strange as it may seem, he had coins minted in his 8th and 9th years. There can be little doubt that Herod Agrippa I died in the year of the Caesarian Games established by King Herod in 9 BC. They were held every 4 years. This makes the 7 years reign of King Herod Agrippa I terminate in 44 AD, just as Josephus attests. But for some reason, he had coins dated to his 8th and 9th year. Did he reckon his regnal years as beginning at least 2 years before Josephus had allowed him an official reign? Well, it looks like that is the case. It should also be mentioned that Agrippa I was awarded the government over Palestine by the Roman Emperor Caligula in 37 AD. Agrippa, however, did not go immediately to Jerusalem to commence his rule, but remained in Rome almost a year and a half after his appointment. He actually governed the area of Judea in absentia when he was not there. Then, in late autumn of 38 AD, he took up his personal rulership at Jerusalem, and he then began to mint coins. On them, he showed his regnal years. He reckoned those years as beginning when, before he actually ruled in Palestine, but at the time he was given the authority by Caligula. Others could have done the same thing. At any rate, scholars recognize that coins often show de jure dates. Professor Mation says, quote, "This is additional proof that coins always record conditions de jure and not de facto." When it comes to Herod Agrippa II, the son of Agrippa I, the evidence from his coins show conclusively that he dated his reign from at least two different eras. And Professor Madden suggests four. On some of the coins, he indicates 2 years of significance, the 6th and the 11th. His official reign over the small territory of Chalcis near Damascus began in 50 AD. And this is the time that Josephus said he assumed the throne. But the coins do not square with this. There are some scholars who feel his regnal years should start as far back as the death of his father in 44 AD, although Mation, one of the main Israeli numismatists who has studied the problems at length, does not think this is possible. The numismatist Meshorer feels that one of Agrippa's eras should start with 56 AD and another in 61 AD. This is the Agrippa II. But there is much confusion in the evidence. Meshorer points out that some of the coins bear the names of three Roman emperors, Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian, and they have three identical dates on them. How could these be dated from one era when all three emperors reigned at different times? Well, no one really knows why these coins have the doubtful dates that they do. But whatever the case, some of the coins do not agree with the years of Agrippa II, as indicated by Josephus. Meshorer has seen the problem and informs us, quote, "The date mentioned by Josephus as the first regnal year of Agrippa II is incompatible with at least some of his coins," end quote. Even more important, however, are coins that were apparently minted by Antipas, one of the immediate successors of Herod the Great. Antipas was removed from his throne in 39 AD and was banished to Europe. If one dates his reign from 4 BC, it means he would have had a reign of 43 years. Indeed, there are three coins of Antipas marked with the regnal reign year of 43. However, there is a coin mentioned by Vellant, and it is also referred to by Garland in his travel narratives, who found it at Jericho in 1674, that has the year 44 inscribed on it. But this would have Antipas commencing his reign in 5 BC. This seems impossible. So much debate has surrounded the interpretation of the year mentioned on this coin. The general opinion is that the date on the coin was probably misread. Since the coin can no longer be traced, it is conjectured that this explanation is probably the best, but no one can be sure. Coins give political data, but not real history. Worse yet, during the last century, a coin came to light which showed year 45 for Antipas' reign. This would have extended Antipas' rule back to 6 BC. Well, what can be done with this coin? Some scholars have thought that Antipas' reign might be extended beyond 39 AD, but this explanation is very unsatisfactory and cannot account for these two unknown regnal years. Still, having Antipas reigning in 6 BC seems like an absurd assessment. As a result, many scholars simply call the coin a forgery. And this is the easy way to cut the Gordian knot. But why is it a forgery? There is not the slightest external evidence for the problem, except the date on the coin. But even the coins of Agrippa I and Agrippa II, who lived within the later years of Antipas, also have regnal years recorded on them before Josephus reported them reigning, and few dispute these coins. No one knows why these coins record earlier years than Josephus sometimes allows, but they do. Since inscriptions on coins show legal or governmental recognition about matters of state, often for symbolic reasons, they could be accepted as real evidence that different types of regnal years were in vogue among the sons and grandsons of Herod. Certainly, the years of rule could not have been placed on the coins without the approval of Rome. This is clear evidence that Rome allowed de jure, de jure regnal years. Let's try the mute button here. Did it work?
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay. Which Josephus sometimes, or sometimes not, did not reckon his year lengths of the Herodian successors. Indeed, even Herod himself had three of his regnal years awarded in the de jure manner from the time he was appointed king by the Romans until his capture of Jerusalem 3 years later. It should seem odd that Herod's successors should, in similar fashion, have years of reign assigned to them by the Romans. Even Archelaus, the immediate successor to Herod, had a reign which was acknowledged by Josephus as 9 years in one place and 10 years in another. These discrepancies could legitimately be explained in the de jure manner. The fact is, it was common practice to award special years to Herod and his successors. And while the Roman emperors observed no such regnal years in this manner, the practice was widespread in Judea and other areas of the empire. So it looks like 2 or 3 years were awarded to Archelaus and Antipas, in which they did not rule alone over King Herod's dominions. The coins certainly reveal the existence of de jure years, but most historians find such things rather confusing. In our Western world, there is a natural resistance toward the acceptance of such a reckoning because it is disruptive to a uniform and consistent chronological plan and understanding. Anyone with common sense would share a distaste for using awarded years. The fact is, however, anyone working with the regnal years of the kings and rulers within the Hellenistic period will have to get used to them. It was common practice in the Hellenistic East, of which the region of Judea was a part, for rulers to ascribe, even in an official way, extra years to the lengths of their reigns that fictitiously gave them more years than they actually ruled. In fact, antedating was commonly practiced in the ancient world. Professor E.J. Bickerman has collected a great deal of historical material to show how usual it was for Hellenistic rulers to inflate their lengths of reign, normally by antedating their years of rule. Quote, like Ptolemaeus I, Seleucus I, etc., Attalus of Pergamus antedated their kingship and commuted his regnal years from his succession to Emmaus, in 240 B.C., end quote. Bickerman continues, quote, an official date is not necessarily the authentic one. When a Hellenistic ruler succeeded in gaining the sovereignty, the symbol of which was the royal title, he often antedated the initial year of his kingship. For instance, in the second century B.C., the kings of Pontus computed their regnal years from 336 B.C., when the reputed ancestor Mithridates was established as the governor of Cius, although the dynasty had not assumed the royal title before Mithridates III, brother-in-law of Seleucus II. The Arcasids followed the same patterns, end quote. With the rulers of Bithynia, there is the evidence of using de jure or a fictitious era. The Herodian kingdom was a direct outgrowth of this historical and political environment. Antedating reigns and overlapping of years was certainly nothing new to the Jews. They were well accustomed to it, even within the biblical period. And all you need to do is read Professor Teeley's book, Mysterious Numbers of the Hebrew Kings, page 207, which discusses this point. And lest one think that antedating of reigns is limited simply to the nations of the East in the Hellenistic period, Bickerman points out that Charles II of England was crowned king on the 29th of May, 1660, but for political reasons, he counted his years of reign from the death of Charles I on the 30th of January in 1649. He was the one who was beheaded. It should not seem odd that Herodian successors would do the same thing, especially since the East had a long history of accepting such a practice. And since the coins certainly do show de jure reigns, years of reigns for the Herodians, which cannot be accounted for historically, it would be very unwise to dismiss this deduction as being of little consequence. This is especially so since virtually all the other historical evidence that I have shown in this book, that Dr. Martin has shown in this book, points to King Herod's death as being in 1 BC. Now, there's a reason for the antedating of the reigns. It seems clear that Archelaus and Antipas reckoned their reigns as commencing in 4 BC, at the very time their half-brother Antipater became co-ruler with Herod and acted every bit as king. Why would these two sons want to adopt the practice of antedating? Though the procedure is often used, there still must be some reason why Herod's successors utilized it for dating the beginning of their reigns. When one understands the political and religious positions which the family of the Hasmoneans had with the general Jewish population, both in Palestine and the Roman world, a reason for antedating becomes evident. Recall that Alexander and Aristobulus, the two Hasmonean sons of Herod, met their deaths almost 3 years before Herod himself died. This was a tragic circumstance that all Jewish people, a tragic circumstance to all Jewish people, because the two brothers were considered of royal stock and the legitimate heirs to the throne of Judea. They were considered legal heirs to the kingship. Look at the matter carefully. King Herod the Great was a commoner. Actually, he was not even a Jew by race, but a mixture of Idumean and Arabian stock. He was an Edomite. He, however, had been made king by the Romans to place Hyrcanus, who was a Hasmonean. The Hasmoneans were descendants of the Maccabees, who were of priestly ancestry. These people were reckoned to be of royal priestly blood. The Jewish population considered the Hasmoneans as the only royal line with legal vouchers, legitimate, until someone of the Davidic dynasty could show that he had messianic credentials. This is in Klausner's book, The Messianic Idea of Israel. This fact was well recognized by the Jews. Even Herod saw the importance of the Hasmoneans in his own time of rulership. Herod, in order to legitimize further his own rule, married Miriam of the royal Hasmonean house. Of course, he later killed her. She was reckoned by the Jewish people as queen, but Herod was regarded as, quote, base of birth, according to Josephus. Herod felt that he had to marry the royal Miriam. She gave Herod two sons, and they were acknowledged by the Jewish people as the royal sons and the only ones who could legally be claimants to the throne. even though King Herod had other sons by other wives who had actually time priority. One of the main reasons for this was because the two sons, Alexander and Aristobulus, were born after Herod had assumed the kingship of Judea. These two sons outshone all the other children of Herod in prestige because they were the only regal children. They were reckoned as being, quote, royal birth, of the, quote, royal family, unquote, of royal lineage. They expressed royal conceit, and they exulted in their pride of birth, as Josephus mentions it. The exclusive feeling of royalty attached to these two sons of Miriam, at the expense of the other common children of King Herod, was accepted by the Jewish people. Both young men had, quote, the goodwill of the masses, end quote, behind them, because of their regnal connections. When these two sons were killed, royalty ceased in Judea. Now, Rome accepted the royal sons. Such lineal attachment to ancient dynastic houses was important to the people who lived in the first century. Both the Jews and the Romans looked upon noble lineage as being very significant. An example of this is seen in the remarks of Glaphyra, the wife of Alexander, who was the first son of Miriam and King Herod. She expressed pride in the fact that she was the daughter of the king of Cappadocia and was descended on her father's side from Temeneus, one of the important kings of ancient Macedonia, and on her mother's side from Darius, the son of Hypsastus of Persia. Glaphyra chided King Herod, chided Herod, his other wives, and their children because of their low birth. Sir Ronald Syme has shown that even the Romans were no less interested in family connections with ancient and modern houses than were the peoples of the East. It might be said that dynastic connections were the main themes that granted reasons to rule. Royal descent was looked on as important. But what happened to the two Hasmonean sons? It was a real blow to Judaic society when Herod had the two royal sons killed and as a consequence promoted Antipater, born of a common woman from Idumea, to be their heir. This was almost too much. Antipater knew he had no right to the throne by any reason of birth. And when the two royal sons were killed, Antipater assumed unjust claim to the succession. And this is when Antipater became joint ruler with Herod, and he began to be considered as king in his own right. In time, however, Herod came to see the extreme wickedness of Antipater, and just before his own death, King Herod executed Antipater and gave his kingdom, his joint rule with Antipater, to his three other sons. Once again, all of them were commoners. They were Archelaus, Antipas, and Philip. The first two had a Samaritan woman for a mother, and Philip's mother was a common woman of Judah. Not one of these three successors of King Herod had any royal connections whatever. To them, this must have represented a rather great disadvantage in securing the legal right to rule or to be accepted as ruler in the eyes of the Jews. It was only the command of Herod and Augustus, Emperor Augustus, that gave them their jurisdiction. The Jews themselves would have looked on these commoners as usurpers. In fact, at the death of Herod, many Jews went to Rome to plead with Augustus to make Judea a part of the province of Syria, that it would no longer be ruled by kings. There was then no one of age of prime Hasmonean stock to assume any kingship, and many Jews did not want these commoners ruling over them. If anyone would have been old enough of Hasmonean stock, it would have been a different story. Witness the false Alexander who duped many Jews just after the death of Herod. And this is mentioned in Josephus, Wars of the Jews, Book 2, Sections 101 to 110. The Jews did not mind legal claimants to the throne ruling over them, but not commoners like Archelaus, Antipas, and Philip. What does this show to our question? Well, very much. It indicates that the Jewish people made a distinct separation between commoners and those of royal lineage. They were willing to accept legitimate Hasmoneans, but others had no legal right to rule. A problem arose, however. Herod and Augustus had accepted the commoners, Archelaus, Antipas, and Philip. They had no biblical, traditional, or dynastic right to rule over the Jews. It was just the rule of the sword. These three successors of Herod would no doubt have understood the difficulty in the matter. How could they, in some possible way, secure at least a limited amount of legal approbation from the Jews, since neither they nor their father Herod were of royal Hasmonean stock? Some device was needed to gain a measure of legitimate succession. So they antedated their dynastic continuance. Since the Jews and most kingdoms of the Hellenistic East were used to antedating reigns to give political or dynastic significance to present rulership, why not antedate the reigns of the three Herodian successors back to the deaths of the two royal sons? Such a thing would have gained some respect in the minds of the more ignorant Jewish population and also later generations, or later, 10, 20 years from them. It would not only have blotted out Antipater's two-year joint rule with Herod when he was reckoned as a king, but it would have linked up the reigns of the three successors with the two royal children. Later history of Palestine in the Middle East certainly supports this proposition. Look at what happened with those three successors. Archelaus was deposed in 6 AD and banished to Gaul. No successor to Archelaus was appointed. His region of rule was then annexed to the empire. Judea became part of the Syrian province of Rome. Philip died in 36 AD, and his territory was eventually given to Agrippa I, a Hasmonean. As Antipas also died in exile, and Agrippa I came to rule his region as well. The fact is, after the reign of these three commoners was over, the sovereigns connected with the Herodian family that later ruled in the East were descendants of royal Hasmonean stock. This must be significant. Indeed, when the Emperor Claudius bestowed royal power on Agrippa I, he not only gave him all the lands that had formerly been under the rule of his grandfather Herod, but Claudius specifically said he was awarded the grant because it was, quote, was due to his family, end quote. That family or dynasty was that of the Hasmoneans. It was the only family with a legal right to rule in Judea. Even Josephus, who wrote in the last part of the first century, stated that, in Jewish opinion, a connection with the priesthood is the hallmark, quote, of an illustrious line, end quote. The Hasmoneans were such priests. Josephus himself said, quote, on my mother's side, I am of royal blood from the posterity of the Hasmoneans, end quote. There can be no doubt of the importance of the Hasmoneans among the Jews as the only legal heirs to the Judean throne. And after the deaths of the three successors of Herod, who were all commoners, nothing but Hasmoneans were allowed to rule in Judea, even in the eastern provinces by the Romans. Note the following kings, table of kings and queens. There was Agrippa the First, then Agrippa the Second, then Herod of Chalcedon, then Aristobulus of Lesser Armenia, Tigranes the Fourth of Armenia, Tigranes the Fifth of Armenia, Alexander of Cilicia, Drusilla, queen of Emesa, and then wife of Felix, mentioned in the Book of Acts, Bernice, queen of Chalcedon, and then of Cilicia. All of these rulers were Hasmonean. This proclivity to accept only Hasmonean stock for later rulers in certain eastern areas surely shows that the Jews desired the Romans to allow only legitimate lineage to reign. Rome consistently accepted the concept as the proper one to follow. Antedating was used to achieve dynastic association. Even as early as the time of Herod, the inclination for such legal rule was evident among the Jews. This gives good reason why two of the successors of Herod would have had their regnal years reckoned back to the deaths of the legal recipients to the throne. Since antedating was so prevalent in the Hellenistic East, such a procedure would not have appeared odd at all. Even Herod may have desired it. Just before Herod's death, when he finally came to realize that Antipater had lied about the two royal sons to get them killed, Herod expressed remorse for the deaths of his Hasmonean children. It could well have been recorded in his final will that all recognition of Antipater be expunged from the records to follow the biblical usage of Deuteronomy 29, verses 17 to 21. Herod also desired the children of the two royal sons to be accepted by the Jews and the other members of the family. Antedating the reigns of Archelaus and Antipas to comprise the 2 years of the joint rule of Antipater could have been one way to secure his recognition, as well as to give some legitimacy to the three commoners in their own rulerships. With Philip, however, we now know from the research of Bayer that the early manuscripts of Josephus show that Philip commenced his reign at the exact period of time of Herod's death in 1 BC and ruled for 37 years, dying in 36 AD, the 22nd year of Tiberius. And all of this makes good sense. So, something approaching this explanation must be the reason why the successors of Herod commenced the reckoning of their regnal reigns in 4 BC. In no way could Herod have died in 4 BC. The historical evidence provided in this book is decidedly against such a proposition. Perhaps the obscure statement of Josephus that Archelaus, only a few weeks after receiving his right to rule, was accused by his opponents as, quote, having long exercised royal authority, can make better sense. This certainly was not true in actual sense, in actual fact, but through the practice of antedating, such a statement could be accepted in a de jure manner. Thus, the obscure chronology of Josephus in regard to Herod's death and the regnal years of his successors can be solved in a satisfactory way and in accord with the accepted practices in the Hellenistic East that were in existence at the time. In closing, it would be profitable to mention that Josephus was well aware of the tendency within the Judean kingdoms, whether of Herod's or earlier ones, to have joint rules of some of their sovereigns. Josephus mentioned the early 1st century BC co-rulership of Hyrcanus II when he came to power in 70 BC with that of his mother, Queen Alexandria. For Hyrcanus' first two years, he was jointly ruling with his own mother. Such joint rules were common in this period. Thus, Antipater jointly ruled with King Herod, and it appears that the other two common sons of Herod were also awarded such rules, antedating their beginning of their reigns. Whatever the case, the evidence of history, archaeology, and astronomy is now showing that King Herod died in early 1 BC and that Jesus was born in 3 BC. This is the period of time from 3 to 2 BC when the majority of Christian historians place the nativity of Jesus, and they are indeed correct. What we are beginning to discover is that, quote, the obscure decade, end quote, from 6 BC to 4 AD in Roman history is now taking on a great deal of light. And the key to the illumination happens to be the historical and chronological indications in the New Testament. And now to close, we'll give a chronological rundown of events. The Nativity occurred on September 11, 3 BC, following the sequence of events, of historical events, from the beginning. Joseph and Mary journey to Bethlehem for the census that occurred at the very close of the Jewish civil year, an apt time for a registration of peoples to occur. It was in the summer season before the rain set in that would have made such travel difficult. Jesus was born in a stable in the twilight period of September 11th, the Day of Trumpets, 3 BC. He was circumcised on September 18th, 3 BC, 8 days later, the eighth day for the circumcision rite. The eighth day is reckoned inclusively. He was dedicated in the temple on October 20 or 21st in 3 BC. Luke says they returned to Galilee, their own city. This is in Luke 2, verse 39. This means they did not go to Egypt after the birth of Jesus. After all, they had only gone to Bethlehem for the census, not to move there. So the family returned to Nazareth in the latter part of October, 3 BC. Then, for some reason, they decided to move to Bethlehem. This could have been in the spring or summer of 2 BC. They set up house, having no need for the temporary type of shelter they had when Jesus was born. This is in Matthew chapter 2, verse 11. On December 5th, in Kislev 5 of 2 BC, the youth tore down the eagle from the east entrance of the temple. They were subsequently executed. Then on December 25th, 2 BC, when the king planet Jupiter came to its stationary position in mid-Virgo the Virgin, it would have been seen to have, quote, stopped over Bethlehem, end quote, as viewed from a Jerusalem perspective. The Magi then went to Bethlehem and gave the child the gifts that they brought from the east. The child, as Luke says, that Jesus was at that time a toddler. In Greek, a paidon, which in Greek means toddler, not a brephos, which in Greek means an infant. He was old enough to stand and to walk. In the papyrus codex Bodmer 5 of the Proto-Evangelium of James, written in Egypt in the 4th century A.D., it even states that the Magi were able to see Jesus, quote, standing by the side of his mother Mary, unquote, in passage number 21, verse 3. This shows early opinion that the visit of the Magi to give gifts to Jesus was long after his birth. This giving of gifts by the Magi would have occurred during the days of Hanukkah, when Jewish fathers were accustomed to give gifts to their children. It would have appeared quite proper to Jewish people. With the warnings of the Magi, Joseph and Mary immediately took Jesus to Egypt in late December 2 BC, more than a year and a quarter after Jesus' birth. Immediately after this, Herod killed all the male children, quote, from 2 years old and under, end quote, Matthew 2, verse 16. This matter of killing children 2 years old can now make better sense. If Jesus was born on September 11, 3 BC, the slaying of the innocents was about 15 months after his birth. If the conception period were also considered, it comes to about 24 months exactly. This may be a helpful clue that Jesus was indeed born in September 3 BC, and why the Magi saw Jesus, quote, standing by the side of his mother Mary, according to a non-biblical source. Soon afterward, two illustrious rabbis were tried and sentenced by the Sanhedrin, and this would have been in early January of 1 BC. Then a few days later, on January 10th, the correct eclipse of the moon occurred that Josephus mentions. Herod then died on January 28th in 1 BC. Later in the spring of 1 BC, the Passover occurred, during which 3,000 Jewish worshippers lost their lives in the temple. In the summer and autumn of that year, in 1 BC, the War of Varus took place. Then, about 28 years later, Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist sometime in either October or November of 27 AD, at the beginning of a sabbatical year. Jesus then began his official ministry with the Passover and Pentecost season of 28 AD, and was crucified in 30 AD. If what Dr. Martin is suggesting in this book is true, these are his words, if what I am suggesting in this book is true, a new understanding in the life of Jesus emerges. Not only do many obscure passages in Josephus make sense, but the chronological and theological indications in the New Testament about the birth of Jesus also becomes clearer. Roman history as well becomes more understandable for the middle years of Augustus. And while none of us was living to some 2,000 years ago to prove these points as eyewitnesses, there is enough evidence available to us to give us some reasonable assurance that this new information puts us pretty close to the truth. This means that the Star of Bethlehem can be identified, and that it fits into the overall historical theme to make this period of human history more understandable. This is just another reason why all historians who want to comprehend the proper history of Rome in the early empire period need to focus their attention on the star that astonished the world.
Wow. My goodness. You know, I've got a question, David. Where did all this royal stuff start? I mean,
probably with Nimrod.
Yeah. I was thinking royalty may be related to being a hybrid.
Regarding the the designation of being a king with the hybrid blood from the sons of God. There could be something. I have not found any evidence of that yet, however, although I'm very much aware of that.
Yeah.
And looking very much aware, as I read ancient accounts about early gods, that sort of thing. I mean, even Alexander the Great was considered by many people to have been a hybrid with some type of supernatural being or god.
Yes.
Whether that's the case, I don't know. But we know from Genesis 6 that kind of stuff took place.
Yes.
But none of those descendants, the Anakim, the Rephaim, the Nephilim, none of them became kings necessarily. So maybe there was a two-track system of that. It's well known that many of the kings were touched by the gods. Caligula was a very well-respected military leader until he had a bout with insanity, and nobody knows how that came about.
Yeah.
And then suddenly he just went wacko.
Yeah.
And he was actually a very competent ruler and leader until he had a disease, some type of fever, in which he says he was touched by the gods, and boom, he just went off the deep end, and they had to assassinate him before he destroyed the empire.
Yes.
So who knows? Anyone who reaches a high position of power in today's world or at any time in the past, because they have to climb over so many other people,
Yes. They
feel that they've been helped by God or the gods, and that they are in touch or have a special connection in some way to divinity. And you even see this today in modern rulers.
You're not kidding.
Dr. Martin mentioned to me one time we're running long, so.
No, that's okay. Oh. I didn't mean to interrupt, but when you say we see that today in modern rulers, I was going to say, right here in our own country.
Yeah, yeah. And Dr. Martin even was meeting with an official in the Israeli government one time, and he was told, just matter-of-factly, that we know we are fulfilling biblical prophecy.
Oh, dear.
Just by being there. And whether that's still the thought of the rulers of Israel at this present time, I don't know. But I've heard rumors that I've never been able to confirm that Begin felt that way. Certainly Golda Meir did not, because she was a socialist,
yeah,
if not a communist. She was certainly a major socialist when she lived in Milwaukee, where I grew up, in the 1920s, before she emigrated overseas, when she taught in Milwaukee. But she was known as a raving, raving socialist. But so a lot of people, think that they have a divine right to rule, divine right of kings. And I have conducted a little bit of research to try and nail that down. There's talk about the blue blood of kings, but the blue blood appears to be an inbred genetic defect rather than a touched from the gods positive designator.
Yeah.
So,
it just seems like they have this feeling that we're dirt. We're just garbage to be disposed of at will. Go fight their wars for their own profit. I don't know. I just look at this royal stuff as being tied to the demonic. David, if it weren't for governments, people would probably get along a lot better,
Kingship is a recognized mode of rulership throughout most of history, so.
Well, but look at the root word, Cain and King. And Cain was the first murderer. There's not a king that's been, mortal people.
Right.
That hasn't engaged in genocide or war or murder of some kind.
Yeah, David was not allowed to build a temple because he was a man of blood, but
yeah,
he was anointed by God himself and chosen by God. So was Solomon over all the others. So were all the good kings. Well, every king was, of Judah was. So, you can't say that kingship itself is illegitimate. You certainly can't say that. God designated Nebuchadnezzar to do what he did as God's hammer. So, how do you deal with that? I agree with you on an emotional level, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it is an emotional level. And, I see so much hurt in the world, and most of it is brought on by governments.
Well, to a certain extent, all government is organized crime and a Ponzi scheme.
Right.
But that's, that's the system, that's the Babylonian system that we're designated to live under at the moment. So it's from God, too, God placed the Egyptians and even the Israelites under bondage and slavery. He allowed that to happen. And even arrange circumstances so that it would happen under Joseph, under the Pharaoh, in this, when the famine hit.
Yeah.
Joseph arranged for all the land to create the first absolute king under Pharaoh, and then that king supposedly, when the warped workings of the human mind,
yeah,
instead of being just a king, he became a god.
Yes.
Pharaoh did.
Yeah, well, that seems like it happens to an awful lot of them throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean just in Scripture. I mean just in the world at large.
Well, all those ancient religions, there had to be a tie. In order to get the support of the priesthood, the king had to participate in the pagan religions, all of which were demonic-driven,
yeah,
and all of them had communication with the entities,
oh, yeah,
on a regular basis.
Yes.
Otherwise, they wouldn't have bothered.
Yeah.
part of it was social control, as we've covered in the part, you know, the presentation on double doctrine.
Right.
But, you know, a lot of it was that there was stuff going on. They did get messages and advice and treatment from these non-physical entities. And, you know, and once that stopped at the time of Christ, a lot of these pagan systems, you know, they just became pro forma and had no real guts to them. They had no communications. Even the oracles stopped.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, because of Christ's domination over the spirit realm,
right,
after his resurrection.
Right.
And, you know, this is well known. This is well talked about by Eusebius and even pagan writers. They're wondering, well, you know, what happened? So.
Well, I hope he hurries back soon.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because things are not looking good anywhere on this planet. And it's just, you know, people, the greed just goes rampant. It's just incredible, David, what is passing as education in public schools today. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know, oh my gosh. But anyway, I have really enjoyed this series. This has been very informative. And as you know, I like history, so yes. So anyway, everybody, go check out AskElm.com, AskElm.com. And you can email David Seeloff at this address, David@@, you know, AskElm.com. And we will be back. Are we going to do the...
I'd like to do the Restoring the Original Bible and get into that.
Okay. Oh, wow.
That'll be more straightforward and
yes.
easier and less involved. And
yes.
you'll learn more about the Bible than and Bible, the background to the Bible, than you ever dreamed possible.
Well, I think so. That would be good for anybody that reads the Bible.
Oh, yeah.
You bet. Oh, thank you, David, so much.
Thanks to the Bite Show.
And everybody, God bless you. Study. There are wonderful books to read outside of the Bible that will give you an awful lot of insights. So anyway, God bless you all, and you too, David Seeloff. Good night.